Good evening. This is Statehouse Watch on WNHN. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're here from the American Friends Service Committee New Hampshire program. Now in our eighth year of bringing you Statehouse Watch Radio.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
And 10th year of doing a weekly State House Watch newsletter, which comes out every Friday, and you can subscribe to that by going to our website at afsc.org/NH.
That's right. And what else?
Yeah.
And well, as I think most of our listeners would know, State House Watch Radio, State House Watch Newsletter are an in-depth look at the goings-on, the state policymaking that happens there, with an eye toward how people, activists, and regular folks can make their voices heard, whether that's showing up at hearings or responding to action alerts. But a whole variety of issues that pertain to human well-being are addressed there every year in the form of 800 to 1,000 bills.
Yeah, we were just talking a little bit ago, Maggie, about a colleague of ours who, grew up in Concord and didn't know that he could go to the State House and speak at hearings and thought maybe he'd get in trouble or something like that.
Right.
So part of the point of this whole enterprise is to make the process accessible to,
non-wonky folks, non-policymakers.
So that people can understand
non-professional advocates.
Right. And make it possible for us to figure out how, when to raise our voices in order to affect the people who are making decisions over there. One of those people, by the way, is Andrew Volinsky. He's a member of the Executive Council, and he'll be our guest in a little while here in the studio.
And I think Andrew has been on our inaugural show each year. Is that right?
Well, this is, I think,
or for several years in a row.
This might be year four. We'll ask him that question. Okay. He might know the answer to that.
He gives us a good overview of what's on the horizon.
But
what's going
on
at the Executive
horizon.
Council? Too?
In any case, but the legislature, the Senate, and the House come back to Concord on Wednesday. Their sessions start at 10 a.m. And they begin, as they do in the second year of the two-year session, which they call the biennium. They begin with a look at all the bills which were held over that were retained in the House and re-referred in the Senate, bills that they didn't quite deal with. They sent them back to committees, and now the committees have to come out with a report.
Some kind of report, right.
Yeah. And the report is either that now we think the bill ought to pass, we think the bill is inexpedient to legislate or should be defeated, we think the bill should pass with an amendment, or now sometimes, whereas last year if they had a bill that they didn't really want to deal with, they would re-refer it. Now they can recommend that it be sent to interim study.
And still not deal with it.
Or deal with it later on if they really want to. But so it's hard to tell right now sometimes whether some of those bills are just getting sort of a cold shoulder, whether this is just a polite way to kill it without killing it, or whether in fact these are bills that have sufficient complexity or nuance that the legislatures really feel like, no, some additional attention needs to be given to this so that we make sure that we're doing something that needs to get done.
That's right. And another thing that happens a lot in the second year, it seems to be happening a lot this second year, is that when multiple bills are introduced on a certain subject, one might move forward and others are held back. And in the case of multiple vetoes in the 2019 session, those kind of copy bills or bills that have the same focus can be a way of having that debate again and bringing something back to the governor for another.
Let's give one example of that, which is the proposal to create a family and medical leave system, which last year was the subject of a bill in the Senate, which was SB1. It was the subject of a bill in the House, and it was also introduced as part of the budget.
Yeah.
And ultimately, SB1, I believe, passed and was vetoed by the governor, but then they put it into the budget, and then the governor vetoed the budget in the compromise that ensued in order to make it possible for there to be a budget. The Democrats agreed to leave out the family medical leave proposal, but then meanwhile, the third bite of the apple, which was the House bill, was retained in the House Finance Committee, and now that's coming out as a retained bill and will be on the floor on Wednesday or Thursday this week.
Will be on the floor of the House.
Of the House. So then if it passes, now it goes over to the Senate, which will then have another public hearing on it, and once again, we're back where we back where we were last year, perhaps.
And let's be sure to talk with Andrew Volinsky about what is some advice we might have for advocates trying again with a much-needed, important, valuable policy. Do we simply kind of just expect the same thing happening this year as last year, or are there ways that it could be approached that might give it a better chance of success, or that would put more pressure on the governor to act differently?
I think one of the sort of treetop level questions, Maggie, for the legislature or for us as legislative watchers as it starts up again is how much is 2020 just a replay of 2019 with the same bills or the same issues going forward with the same more or less support from the Democratic majorities in the House and Senate and the same resistance from the governor with another veto. So last year, I believe he vetoed 55 bills, a new state.
57.
57, okay, that's right, because there were 55 that were sustained and two that were overturned, including the death penalty repeal.
Yay.
And whether we're going to see a competition from himself with his own record or whether something will actually look different this time.
Yeah. And there's always a question of in a nearly perpetual election cycle, how much is an election year kind of just ensuring that it will be a replay or that it makes some new possibilities, as people have to answer to their constituents who may have real need for family and medical leave insurance, for example.
The one thing we can say will be different is that the budget is a two-year budget, so there's not a budget proposal this year. Now, that takes up a great deal of the oxygen during the first year of the biennium. With it not being there this year, we get a little bit of a reprieve from that, and legislators can give attention to some other issues, perhaps.
That's right. So. Anything strike you? I know you reviewed the list of legislative service requests. Anything stick out for you as just kind of a funny little thing we might be watching? I saw a bill about hunting with ferrets.
Yeah, there's a lot of animal related bills, which again, this is serious stuff. There's a lot of things about animals that we care about. So anyway,
yes,
I don't know,
well-being. But, yeah.
I don't remember any new state whatever's this year to be paying attention to.
I don't think so.
So,
it's always worth a look because there's things in there that are amusing as well.
Whether it's okay to carry cats in an open pickup truck or whatever like that. I don't know. I don't remember what else is there.
But it's a participatory
But we will keep
democracy.
An eye on that. And if we don't have a chance to talk about that here on our radio show, you can certainly read about it in the State House Watch newsletter where we'll cover some of these issues that we just don't have time for here.
Which has already come out once. Friday, January 3rd was our first issue of the year. And we gave you a whole rundown of the bills that we would prioritize that are going to be on the House and Senate floors.
And the newsletter, by the way, also does get posted on our Facebook page and on our website. So if you missed it for whatever reason, the easiest thing is to go to our webpage and sign up to subscribe. But if you need to go back and look at it somewhere else, it's there. The latest issue is always right up there on our website where you can find it.
That's
right.
And
the Take Action section at afsc.org/NH. Maggie, let's talk about a couple of bills that are going to come up this year?
Yes.
Or come up this week?
Yeah, let's talk about the minimum wage because that's an example of what we were talking about before, too, of multiple bills.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Last year, there were three minimum wage bills in the House and one in the Senate. The Senate bill sponsored by Senate President Donna Soucy, which would have raised the minimum wage in, I believe, three steps from its existing non-minimum wage, but at the federal level of $7.25 an hour, in three steps to $12 an hour by 2022. That was ultimately passed in the Senate and in the House and was vetoed by the governor, and the override vote in the Senate was the same as the original vote, so that died.
Mm-hmm.
There was another minimum wage bill. It's very similar to Senator Soucy's bill introduced by my representative, Howie Moffitt from Canterbury, that likewise would have raised the minimum wage in three steps to $12 an hour by 2022. That passed the House. And when it got to the Senate, they decided to re-refer it. So it was re-referred to the Commerce Committee. It's coming back out of the Commerce Committee on Wednesday with a recommendation to send it to interim study. But I just saw a little video that Senator Soucy made talking about her priorities for the year, and she says again that one of her priorities is to raise the minimum wage. So I'm not exactly sure about that, but one of the things is that Senate rules are much more flexible than House rules,
mm-hmm.
Because there's so many So fewer of them. It's possible for them to have later deadlines. It's possible for them to have what they call confidential LSRs or bills that can get brought out late. So it may be that that's what's happening on the Senate side, and we'll keep an eye on it. But then finally, the other bill,
HB 731,
which was introduced by Concord Representative Chris Schultz. She just lives up the road from us here. Up the road from the studio.
Yes.
And this was a bill that, consistent with the Raise the Minimum Wage Act, which is being considered in Washington on Capitol Hill, and consistent with the practices in a lot of our neighboring and other states, would raise the minimum wage in four steps to $15 an hour by 2024. Mm-hmm. That was retained in the House Labor Committee, which decided to amend it. So the House Labor Committee has a proposal coming out then, which instead of taking the minimum wage to 15 by 2024, would take it only to $13 an hour. And then there's another floor amendment coming out from another member that would raise the minimum wage once to $10 an hour and then just leave it there. Now, this is while the minimum wage in the neighboring states are all going up.
All way higher.
And for that matter, the actual wages that people are getting paid, by and large, are also going up because of a tight labor market.
Mm-hmm.
Employers are needing to pay people more in order to get them to come to work. And that's also the way.
And places are closing. In my own Dover, places are closing because
they can't find workers. So how about that? So anyway, so the message that's coming from the New Hampshire Alliance for a Moral Economy and its Raise Up New Hampshire project is to encourage the representatives to defeat the $13 amendment, defeat the $10 amendment, and pass Representative Schultz's bill as it was written, and then send that back over to the Senate.
Yeah.
And then we'll take it from there.
So what is your sense of the justification for seeking a lower wage than the 15? I mean, $15 hour minimum wage is in the Democratic Party platform, for example. The Democrats have the majority of the House and Senate.
And we'd also say that even $15 an hour does not get even close to what is a living wage. It's sort of it's about half of what you need to actually be able to afford housing
and everything else. Yeah.
But I think, Maggie, that what's going on is there's still some idea that $15 seems like an outrageously large amount of money, and that if the governor vetoes a $15 bill, that it will look like a reasonable thing to do. And I think that they're just not willing to take a stand for what needs to be done.
So then it's on us. It's on advocates and people who care about this and low-wage workers to make clear to our elected officials that we want them to defend $15 an hour, right? I mean, if our electeds are feeling fearful, then we have to make them more concerned about upsetting their constituents who want a higher minimum wage.
Right. The median monthly gross rent for a two-bedroom apartment in New Hampshire is now up around $1,350 a month, right? Mm. You cannot afford that on 7.25. Frankly, you can't even afford it on $15 an hour.
That's right.
So that's what we need the legislators to understand, that type of thing, and to actually stand up for something.
Yeah. And if we're going to get vetoed, let's fight for what we want.
Well, I think that's the case.
Yeah.
All right, good. Maggie, there's another bill that I know you've been watching closely, a House Bill 397 that expands access to driver licenses. So give our listeners a quick recap of what that is and what its status is at the moment.
Yes, so this bill would expand access to driver licenses, not the real ID driver license, but the other kind of regular non-compliant driver license that plenty of New Hampshire people have, would expand it to people whose immigration status is uncertain or who don't have a legal permanent residency or other kinds of qualifying statuses. This bill is based on the logic that people with uncertain immigration status are living among us. They are workers in our economy. They are parents of children in our schools. They are members of our communities, our faith communities, et cetera. And driving is a basic and essential part of life for people in New Hampshire. Driving should not be related to immigration at all. So until Congress can fix the mess, the chaotic, brutal mess that is our immigration system, we as the state of New Hampshire might as well make sure that people can go about living their lives without fear that a traffic stop is going to tear a family apart. So this bill, with the leadership of Representative Sykes and strong support from the Transportation Committee, passed the House by a vote almost nearly on partisan lines, but yeah, by a significant margin. When it came to the Senate Transportation Committee had a hearing on it where they heard from a number of immigrant community leaders, powerful testimony, but there didn't appear to be sufficient support for the bill as is. There were concerns from the Department of Motor Vehicles about how they would adapt to these changes. There were some concerns about privacy protections in an increasingly aggressive enforcement environment with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and then just some resistance to the concept based on misinformation that, oh, this would make it possible for people to vote. No, it would not. You need to be a citizen to vote. This doesn't change that. There are plenty of people with driver licenses who are not eligible to vote. Anyway, the Senate Transportation Committee did a responsible thing, amended the bill to make it a study committee so that we can bring a lot of people together to hear those concerns, craft a bill that would get majority support. And so the Senate on Wednesday will be taking up HB 397 as amended to be a study committee about driver license access for undocumented immigrants. And we hope the bill out of the Senate committee was bipartisan, 4-0. We hope the Senate will see this as a wise path. And then we got to get it through the House and to the governor. And hopefully we'll have a good, robust study this year and be able to move forward on the bill itself in 2021.
Right. As we can mention that New York and New Jersey have just done at the beginning of this year.
That's right. So and that's the New York one survived a court challenge. Yeah. Although simultaneously we're hearing that Immigration and Customs and the Trump administration is
Homeland Security taking a challenge on that. Anyway, later on, we're not going to spend time on it today, but the difference between interim study and a study committee is one more of those subtle things that you can learn about by reading State House Watch and listening to our radio show. I would like to mention before we go to a music break that as I think all of our listeners know, the Trump administration has dangerously escalated tensions in the world with a drone attack on an Iranian general and also taking out some Iraqi militia leaders, putting that region and really the whole world on the brink of a serious military conflict. If you would like to send a message to our congressional delegation that says no war with Iran, you can just go to our website at afsc.org, and the click is right there for the no war with Iran website, and you can figure
they
that
need
out
to
and
hear
find
from
some
us.
Additional information. And on the blog section of the website, there's 5 things to know about Iran, very clear, basic information that we hope people will take a look at. Before we bring in Executive Counselor Valinsky, though, I want to play our first song of the year, and this is Layla McCalla. So Layla McCalla was part of the Carolina Chocolate Drops and has put out a really cool album that I believe is called The Capitalist Blues.
If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. He can commit murder and get off free. Live in the governor's company. But if you are poor, people tell you, shoo, a dog is better than you. At the door, Carlton lads to take down anything, whiskey cloth earring and diamond ring, send it to your home on a motorbike, you can pay the bill whenever you like, and not a soul will ask you a thing, they know very well that money is king. Take him down to you see how a dog is better than you.
Sakala, Money is King. So how about that?
That's a great voice.
Yeah, we'll be hearing more from her.
So she's active now? Is she still
producing? Oh, yeah, this is a
producing?
New album of hers. I believe it's called The Capitalist Blues is her name of her new project, and we'll be hearing a little bit more from her
in future shows. Don't get old, that's
how
for sure.
How about that? Anyway, you are listening to State House Watch on WNHN-LP, Low Power to the People here in Concord. And you can go to WNHNFM.org and find out about all the other great programs that are here. You can click the donate button. You can download podcasts of our back shows and of this one in a little while. And it gives us great pleasure to welcome Executive Counselor Andrew Valinsky back to the studio.
Hey, it's great to be here. Hi, Maggie and Arnie and, of course, Fred.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing me back.
Do we think this is your fourth year helping us kick off, maybe?
I think it's the third year.
Third year? Okay, good. And how many years have you been in the council now?
This is my third year.
Third year in the executive
council. Yeah, so it's
council.
My second term.
Second
I'm halfway
term.
Through
right.
it.
Halfway
so I think you've
it.
Had me do it from
All
the
right.
start.
All right. Well, I just want to mention for our listeners, they may know that Andrew's actually running for governor. But that's not what we're going to be talking about today. This show does not generally deal with the sort of electoral politics. We really like to talk about the issues that face our lawmakers and face executive counselors.
Right. And how our government works for us.
Yeah. Yep, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, so I'm just, again, I think for a lot of people still, despite our best efforts, the executive council is still a somewhat obscure branch of our government.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's just a quick reminder of what the council does and maybe use the upcoming nomination of a Health and Human Service Commissioner as an example.
Sure.
How that works.
So the quick way to remember what the council does is to think of the three C's. We do confirmations, contracts, and commuting.
Commuting?
Yeah. The council's responsible for the 10-year transportation plan.
Okay. Thank
and
you. That's
the
helpful.
Council sets tolls. And this year we zeroed out the toll in Merrimack. That was a council action. So that was 5-0. Council agreed to do that. There's a history behind that, but let's put that aside. So confirmation.
I'm curious now, but I know we have lots to talk about.
Yep. So the governor nominates the department heads and judges in the state, and it's the council's responsibility by a majority vote to confirm them. Contracts, every contract over 10,000 essentially has to get approved by a majority of the councilors. And then, as I said, we start the transportation planning process. So you mentioned the upcoming hearing.
Yes.
So we have a hearing on Wednesday at 1 o'clock at council chambers. It's open to the public. The public is welcome to come watch or testify. Yes, it's a public hearing. So if people are uncomfortable testifying and want to submit a written letter or email, they can email GC Webb, Governor Council Webb, .gov, and it goes to all the counselors, and they can express their opinion. And they could write to us by snail mail as well or show up.
Wow.
So the hearing on Wednesday is of the nominee to become the commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services, Lori Chibonette. Lori is currently the head of the New Hampshire Hospital, and before that she was deputy commissioner under Commissioner Myers. Commissioner Myers has given his resignation. His last day was, I think, December 6th. And we've had the CFO of the department as acting commissioner since Jeff Myers finished his term.
Okay. So this candidate is known, though, to her department, certainly, and to the executive counselors? Or do you go in with a lot of questions that you'll want answers to?
Right. So I personally met with Ms. Chibonette. We talked for an hour and a half about her philosophy and approach and her thoughts about various issues. I think most of the other counselors did something similar. Mm-hmm. But that's a private meeting. Government should take place in public. Mm-hmm. And so I intend to ask questions along the same lines. It's just a little easier for me to follow the line of thought if I'm doing it in private rather than catch. And it's also fair to the nominee to let her know the areas of inquiry that are important to me.
To you.
And not unexpectedly, there are a couple of things that she wanted to give more thought to.
Yeah.
Perfectly appropriate.
Sure.
It was a good meeting. She's a well-respected administrator. The way the timing that this happened made it hard for the state to go out of Department of Health and Human Services to bring in someone from the outside.
Meaning there wasn't much notice?
There wasn't a lot of notice. And so that limited the candidates and I'm sure limited the governor's choice as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of issues on the table. We've had significant problems at the Sununu Center with overdoses among the adolescent population there. The adolescent treatment program is closed down right now. Mm-hmm. The ombudsman, Moira O'Neill, raised major issues about the lack of supervision of this private contractor. The next Health and Human Services Commissioner will have to think about that very hard. Mm. There are big issues about how we use the entirety of the Sununu Center, whether we should use it. There's the fact that we lock up non-criminals at the secure psychiatric unit in the prison. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. I think Jeff Myers did an admirable job bringing money into the state through his dealings with the federal delegation. But I think we've been less than stellar in how we
implement programs.
There have been a number of problems. And I don't want to blame that on Commissioner Myers, but it's fair to say we had a nation-leading community mental health system in our state when Don Shumway was the commissioner. And over the years, from lack of funding, we allowed that system to wither on the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have this horrible, horrible opioid crisis, and we don't have a well-stood-up community mental health system.
Yeah.
And so one of my pet peeves is that we're want to think of how to say this. We're too myopic. We're too proud. We're the ones to figure this out and do it. So the governor set up a hub and spoke system.
Mm-hmm.
I think he publicly said he invented it. Vermont's had a hub and spoke system for 4 or 5 years longer than us.
Mm.
And so I went and talked to the people in Vermont.
Maybe he invented theirs.
Maybe he invented theirs.
All right.
But we need to learn from others.
Yes, and be willing
That's
to do that.
That's the point yeah. of right. this. Okay. And so
the crisis is too great right. to not
yes,
have that.
Yes, there's no room before the fall. Pride goes before the fall.
Yeah, yeah.
There's
too
no
much
room.
At stake.
Well, you mentioned your pet peeve, so I'm going to use that as a segue to talk about education.
Before we leave HHS, right. though, okay. can I just right. ask, because we've been paying attention right. to this back of the budget cut of $25 million, maybe even
yeah.
say what is the back of the budget, like doesn't
yeah.
the state legislature appropriate funds and shouldn't they do it on the front of the budget? So, but the new commissioner is going to have to deal with that. Are those going to be
right.
questions that would be dealt with at this hearing
yes.
on Wednesday? And do you have any information of your own perspective, I guess?
I expect it to come up at the hearing. So what this is, the legislature ordinarily appropriates based on a programmatic basis so that we know what the legislature is approving when they appropriate
yeah.
in order to get through the budget crisis because of the veto, the parties involved, the council doesn't have a role with the budget, so it's the governor and the legislature. The parties involved that agreed there would be a $25 million cut in
Somewhere.
The Department of Health and Human Services. So it's limited to that
yeah,
department.
To that department.
But there's no delineation of what programs get the axe.
Well, they said it would not be developmental services.
That's
but
right.
Otherwise, what it would be, it's unclear.
We don't know.
And the governor says he thinks he can do it without layoffs, but it's unclear what gets cut. So it's an interesting
heck of a way to build a budget
that we are in right now. This is State House Watch on WNHN-LP. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we're with Executive Counselor Andrew Volinsky.
Yeah.
I mean, how will we know what's being threatened by those decisions so in a timely way to respond?
You can expect a certain executive counselor to be asking questions
we'll be
about that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's not a real clear, transparent way to get that information. I think there's interest among all the parties to make it public.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll have to remind the HHS personnel that we want to know it and before it's implemented.
And so maybe in a comment period type format?
So when we have the HHS contracts before the council and we meet on a biweekly, every other Wednesday morning basis, there's opportunity for us to ask more questions than simply the contracts. And so you can bet that it'll be an – there are a couple of us.
The discussion will continue that way.
Yeah, and this isn't partisan among the five of us. All five of us are interested in what these cuts will be.
Great. Right, thank you
for
that.
So back
that
to,
was helpful.
I think, Andrew Walensky, if you're known for anything, it's you are known as an advocate for public education in the state. And one of the things that's very controversial in recent months have been some issues having to do with charter schools and whether the state would accept a large federal grant to support expansion of the charter school system, which is a pet project, one might say, of the Commissioner of Education, Frank Edelblut, a person who you have actually called for him to be fired or for the governor to ask for him to resign.
Yeah.
So if you could just go over for us pretty briefly, what are the problems that you're seeing right now with the whole charter school situation and what is necessary to get back on track for New Hampshire to have an adequately funded and decent public school system in the state?
Yeah, that's we have a couple
seconds,
hours.
Whatever. Yeah. We'll hit some highlights here. Yeah.
So let's focus on the charter schools.
Sure.
So we have essentially 165,000 school children in our state. Somewhere, depending on how you count them, 2,000 and 3,000. Somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 go to charter schools. Okay, so it's a small percentage. Frank Edelblut is the Commissioner of Education. Without broad discussion, without public hearings, really without a lot of people knowing about it, worked with Betsy DeVos, the U.S. Education Commissioner. I won't put any adjectives in. And arranged for New Hampshire to receive a $46 million grant. And that grant was intended to double the number of charter students in the state. So it would bring us to about 6,000 or so charter students in the state, 6,000 to 7,000. The process for receiving a federal grant requires the legislature's fiscal committee to review and approve, and then the executive council gets a shot at reviewing and approving the receipt of the money. This grant failed at the fiscal committee. And it failed based on some grounds that a number of us have raised concerns about. Essentially, this $46 million required a 2x match from state funds. So over $100 million from state funds. And then there would be a second hit to the local property taxes, which would have required local property taxpayers to raise $15 or $20 million to replace lost money that would have been siphoned off or diverted to the charter kids going to these new charter schools. Mm. So it wouldn't have really helped the existing charter schools, would have created additional charters that when you look at the capacity of the current charters, we don't need.
Mm.
And would have further diverted funds from traditional public education in a way that just makes our underfunding, our unfair and inequitable funding of schools now that much worse.
Mm.
And this is the third effort that is big and public by Frank Edelblut to undermine the public education system for private schools and for charter schools. And it was so egregious and obvious an effort by Mr. Edelblut to undermine public schools that I asked the governor to seek Mr. Edelblut's resignation.
Mm.
And that happened last week.
Wow.
The request was last week.
Yes.
Resignation.
Yeah, I'm still waiting.
An announcement.
Yet to take place. Yeah.
Yeah, I've not heard a response from the governor, nor do I expect. I mean, he hired Edelblut Edelblut agreed to support him in the primary or in the general election.
After primarying, after being an opponent in the primary.
In the primary.
So it was a way to, get
to take care of that.
Get him into the tent. So
is that particular offer of $46 million then no longer in in play? That's been rejected and we move on to other things?
It's been rejected, but I don't really trust the governor and Frank Edelblue, and I expect they'll try and bring it back again.
Oh. But it was stopped in the fiscal committee, not at the executive council.
Correct.
So yeah. Even if it still would have to go through that process in some way in order for the money to come into the system.
Exactly.
Here. This would also be a long-term obligation on the state with a short-term money, which is kind of the opposite of what we've heard the governor in his own budgeting philosophies.
Right.
So we don't want to pay for long-term projects with one-time money, which is really what this would have been.
You would create new charter schools that would continue indefinitely into the future.
Yeah. So, how about that? So
wow, thank you for that
inconsistency
tutorial.
In the process. One of the contracts that is being discussed right now, or could be getting discussed, is a new contract with the members of the State Employees Association, all the state employees.
Switching topics.
Switching topics, yeah. So that contract, the state employees are ready to, as I understand it, to accept the report of a fact finder that would give them a raise over the next couple of years that is higher than the one that the governor is willing to go along with. But the governor has not been willing to allow that fact finder's report to come out before
even
the council.
Make it to the agenda.
To the agenda of the council. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's a fair way to put it. But we know the extent of the dispute, right? The state employees are comfortable accepting the fact finder's report, which recommends a 2% increase for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
so a total of 4%.
Mm-hmm.
The governor has offered 1.16% for 2 years.
Total.
So he's offering 2.32, and the employees want 4.0.
Which is less than what they had originally proposed, but this is where the fact finder
comes out.
That's
where the fact finder is. The idea that you would have such hard feelings between the governor and virtually all the state's employees over what's the difference between 4% and 2.32?
Less than 2%.
1.68.
Yeah. Right.
We can do the math.
That's what we're fighting about. Yeah. And I just think we need some adults in the room, and the governor needs to sign on for the 4%. Which is less than inflation, right?
Yes, right. How can something as significant as the contract for our New Hampshire state employees not be required to be on the agenda for the council to do its work?
Right. So there's potentially a constitutional dispute over whether the governor actually gets to keep that from the council. It's early in the dispute, so it's not there yet, but the state employees had to formally vote to accept the fact finder's report, and that happens by mail over a multi-week period that ended yesterday.
Yeah, so I believe the votes are getting counted, Maggie, right now by the union to see whether their members actually do want to accept the fact finder's report. If that happens, then the process is that the executive council is supposed to also vote on it, but the hitch is that the executive council's agenda is set by
the governor. The
governor controls.
Right. So,
that's the difference between being a responsive body, which is what the council is, and being the governor who gets to set the agenda.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So can we expect the council agenda on Wednesday to include a call for the fact finder's report to be brought forward if the state employees have agreed that they want to go there?
So the agenda is already public,
and
the governor has not put anything about that topic on the agenda.
But in terms of a suggestion that it be placed on the subsequent agenda?
I already suggested it at the last meeting to the governor's consternation.
All right. Well,
but this is the second time this governor has used the power to set the agenda in an unconstitutional fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So you may remember that the governor's nominee for Chief Justice was rejected in July. He lost.
Mm-hmm.
The governor has not nominated a new candidate to go on the Supreme Court. So our Supreme Court, which is our highest judicial body, is down one member and doesn't have a chief.
Wow.
And that's because the governor won't nominate anyone.
Because he's punishing the council for their prior vote.
That's what he says. I don't know how that makes much sense,
yeah.
But yes.
Well, let's take a little musical break here with a message that maybe we'll all hear.
You gotta move. You gotta move. You gotta move. You gotta move. When the law gets ready, they're ready for you. You gotta move. Oh, yeah. You gotta move. You may be high. You may be low. You may be rich. And you may be poor. When the law gets ready, ready for you. You gotta move, yeah. Oh, you gotta move. You may be lame and you cannot walk. You may be mute and you cannot talk. But when the law gets ready, get ready for you. You gotta move, yeah. You gotta move. You gotta move.
All right, that's the unmistakable voice of Aaron Neville, a great
old
gospel song, You've Gotta Move. I found a couple versions of that, Maggie, one by Mississippi Fred McDowell, and I found one by Reverend Gary Davis, and then I picked this. I just love them, you know, anyway.
Yeah,
and we'll get the other ones on here, because You've Got to Move, that just seems like a good State House Watch message
for and a New
every
Year's
week,
resolution.
Maybe. Every week, every week.
So.
Anyway, this is State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty, and we're talking to Executive Counselor Andrew Volinsky about lots of issues of concern to the executive council and to all of us.
And to the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So I just have to say, one of the things that I've been extremely impressed with by your approach to executive counseling is the way in which you have scrutinized all the contracts in terms of the wages actually being paid by contractors to the people that they would be employing. They're working for us.
Yeah.
If our tax dollars are keeping people in poverty, that's really not a good service. So
yeah.
I'm curious what you're finding, and if you're seeing in this tight labor market, if you're seeing wages actually going up in the contracts that you're scrutinizing.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier the moral economy issue. This is our money that the state spends on various kinds of vendors, contractors. I don't think we should spend our money on keeping people in poverty.
Amen.
And so when I first ran for the council, I started to raise this issue. And since being on the council, I always ask, what does this contractor pay its lowest paid worker?
That's
and
great.
I'm generally pleased to find that the lowest paid worker in a labor-oriented contract is in the 13 to 17 range.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
The 15 – and I'm looking for 15, to be frank.
Yeah.
And most of them are there. There are a couple of outliers. There was one that paid $9.75 to its laborers in my first term, and we made a bit of a stink about it, and now they're paying I think it's 14.
Hey.
So
that's a great example of use of leverage.
Well, I tend to think it's more the labor market than me, but thanks anyway.
You ask the questions, you draw attention. Well,
yeah, you have to draw attention to it. And it's, you know, it's a precursor to a prevailing wage law that we should have in our state. And this is one of the points where I think there's not enough collaboration amongst state leaders. Mm-hmm. There are a number of us who are interested in securing a prevailing wage law, which means state jobs, like federal jobs, get paid at a certain living wage.
Yeah.
There were prevailing wage laws in the legislature while I'm raising this issue in the executive council, and there wasn't any coordination. So we had data for them, just no one asked, and we could do better. We need to coordinate. Well, we need to collaborate if we're going to move this kind of issue forward.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly something we can continue to talk about.
Yes, please.
And, with the moral economy group that we're part of and with you and with the legislators that we know. Mm-hmm. So that is a good idea to put on the agenda for the future.
I'm just curious, did we wrap up our discussion about the Supreme Court nomination? Is there anybody in the pipeline? Is that going to come on the agenda or is it at an impasse?
There is no one under consideration. The governor's not hinted that there's anyone forthcoming. You know, there's this maneuver where you accuse the other side of what you're actually doing.
Yes, yeah.
So we've been accused of being political in rejecting Mr. McDonald's nomination. I wasn't being political. I have some very specific reasons.
Yeah.
But the governor is withholding until I think he hopes he wins re-election and he gets a different council.
Mm.
He may find that he waits too long and the next governor gets to nominate a real candidate for Chief Justice and Associate Justice.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that explanation.
Great. Maggie, you had another issue you wanted to talk to Andrew about.
So several weeks ago, an issue was before the council with regard to a contract for Bethany Christian Services.
Yes.
And there were concerns from among immigrant advocates who had seen Bethany Christian Services involved in adoptions of children whose parents had been deported. So can you give a little background about what was the contract before the council, and did council members hear and consider the implications of this kind of behavior around the country, but that includes Bethany?
So there were multiple issues about the Bethany Christian contract. It wound up passing 3-2 with Deborah Pignatelli, the counselor from District 5, Nashua Milford, and I voting against.
Mm-hmm.
Last term, it's a two-year contract that gets renewed. Mm-hmm. Last term, it was 4-1. And I was the lone vote, so wow. Deborah joined me on this one. So Bethany Christian Services is a foster care and adoption agency. It's international in scope. It's funded by the DeVos family in some significant measure.
Wow.
There have been issues with Bethany Christian being sued across the country, in our country, because they refused to deal with people who are same-sex couples because it violated their religious scruples. Yet they were taking federal money to provide foster care, essentially recruitment and training for potential foster parents.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were sued in Michigan and Philadelphia. There are issues with them fostering and sometimes putting up for adoption children who are separated at the border because of their immigration status, separated from their parents at the border. And Bethany is among the leading fostering agencies that take the children from Texas and New Mexico and all the south border communities and moves them throughout the country. They're headquartered in Michigan, so a lot go to Michigan in the upper Midwest while their parents are being deported back to wherever they came from.
Right.
So that's a concern for me.
Absolutely.
Bethany has agreed to abide by the federal restrictions against discrimination in a couple of their lawsuits.
With regard to GLBTQ households or including with regard to the separation of immigrants?
No, not including the separation. Separate issue.
Yeah.
But as you may recall, the federal anti-discrimination protections don't affect gender identity. Mm. They affect gender. So that a person's sexual orientation or their gender identity aren't protected federally. Mm. They're somewhat protected by state law, mm-hmm. but the contract says they'll follow the federal. So it's not much of a protection. I looked at their contract the first time I was on the council and encountered it and was concerned about even if they promise to do the best that they possibly can, their website, their materials, their recruitment materials are all really heavily religious. Mm. And they have every right to do that and be religious in their approach.
To privately fund themselves to do so.
Exactly. So my concern is that we ought not to be having this highly religious agency perform a government function mm-hmm. with government money mm-hmm. when they are involving religion. Then you add the immigration issue. And then the final issue, and this is a DHHS issue, their contract said they would do 500 contacts of a certain nature in the fostering service area, and they did 140. And DHHS said, well, you gave away 1,900 Christmas toys, so we're going to count that towards your fostering contacts.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So my law office is in a mill building in Manchester, and my landlord gave away 1,000 bicycles. That doesn't make him a foster care agency. It makes him a generous corporation, and we should not mix the two.
No. And how big was this contract that was just approved?
$100,000.
Okay.
So 2 years, $100,000, $50,000. That's the other thing is they can't provide the services for $50,000 a year. Mm-hmm. It means that's part of the cost, and then they fundraise. But there's a obvious tension between their religious fundraising mm-hmm. and the state's insistence that they be fair to LGBTQ constituents. Mm-hmm. And so if they're too oriented towards the LGBTQ, they'll lose their fundraising.
Their base, yep.
And it's just a never-ending problem. There's a group in New Hampshire that organized the protests, so there were a lot of people who showed up at the council hearing on the topic and a lot of press. And I have to say, I don't mind people coming to the council and expressing their opinion, mm-hmm. but now I'm getting trolled again by some people associated with this group. I post a picture of my alpaca on my Facebook, and the response is, you voted against the BCS contract.
Wow.
It's like, okay.
Wow. Well, it's an important example just to focus for a second on the immigration separation system that we have, on how money flows to so many entities, whether they be nonprofit foster care centers, county jails, monitoring agencies, telecommunications companies, that there is so much money flowing that's doing real harm to individuals. And we have to pay attention to that and to speak up as you did when it's happening right in front of us. So
yeah,
thank you.
We'll give Councillor Pignatelli credit too.
Yes,
the two of us
you.
Spoke
Absolutely.
About these issues.
Very
well,
good.
So quickly in our last minute or so, what else have you got your eyes on coming up in the Executive Council and in the state of New Hampshire?
Well, I'm really concerned about our ability to implement programming. Particularly with respect to opioid response and mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have monies coming in, and we've had to stand up some agencies pretty quickly to spend the money and respond to the crisis. And I'm looking for the Department of Health and Human Services to really fulfill a supervisory and support role mm-hmm. for these agencies. It doesn't help us to squander the money. We need to spend money efficiently and effectively and productively.
Right.
And that's what I'm looking for.
Well, thank you very
Sounds
much.
Sounds like a good topic for the hearing on Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, good. Well, Councillor Andrew Volinsky, thank you so much for being with us here on State House Watch.
It's always my pleasure.
We will see you over at the State House, I'm sure.
Yes. See you on Wednesday.
And other places. We will see you on Wednesday. We'll be there with the New Hampshire Voices of Faith calling for an increase in the minimum wage, so you can come find us when you're out there. When you're out there in the hall.
Come visit us in the hallway.
Come visit us. All right, great.
Do we want to mention a few events coming
up? Let's mention a few
events.
There's
not a lot just yet, but...
Well, we've got our interfaith prayer vigils for immigrant justice, which have continued. We're now in, like, year three of those?
Well, they started in 2017.
Gosh. Yeah. So we're just 18. About... Anyway, that keeps going. It's the first and third Tuesday of every month, and that means tomorrow... At 9 a.m., we'll be out in front of the Norris Cotton Federal Building in Manchester.
Followed by a meeting of the Immigrant Solidarity Network at 10:30, just down the street at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Arnie, I was really excited to read in State House Watch that screenings of the Equal Justice story, it's called Just Mercy, a film being released nationally over the weekend and again next weekend, and that there's lots of tools for faith communities to lift up
very
these
cool.
issues.
Yeah, and there's another movie actually that's also a mass market movie about having to do with the death penalty and having to do with the burden it places on corrections officers if they're working in institutions where people are being executed. It stars Alfred Woodward as a prison warden. Wrestling with this issue. So it's interesting to see that going on.
Excellent.
So that's good. So, Maggie, the New Hampshire Voices of Faith are going to convene at 9:15 a.m. on Wednesday.
In the Hall of Flags.
In the Hall of Flags.
And we'll be back on Thursday if we're needed. But
if we're needed, we
will be there this Wednesday to welcome back our legislators and raise our voices, in particular on the minimum wage.
One of the things that's been going on over the last couple of weeks is that people connected with the Climate Disobedience Center and 350NH and some other groups have been engaged in active nonviolent direct action to try to block deliveries of coal to the Merrimack Station power plant in Bow. So I've got my eye on that, and perhaps we'll, of course, I can't tell you when the next coal train is coming, but we think it might be next week.
Wow.
So there could be a demonstration taking place closer to home here, in which case we'll tell you about it next week on State House Watch.
Because folks can show up in solidarity, right?
Well, Not just to get
arrested.
Absolutely. We're coming up on Martin Luther King Day in 2 weeks. This will be the 20th year that New Hampshire has actually observed Martin Luther King Day. We'll be creating a calendar of all the different events. And in fact, Maggie is speaking at one such event, and I'm speaking at two.
Yeah.
So anyway,
you
win. We'll have a special episode of State House Watch here for Martin Luther King Day. We want to thank everybody for listening to our show. Remind you that shortly after this show is done, that Fred Portnoy, our estimable producer, engineer, will have this recording in a podcast format, which you can download and listen to at your discretion whenever you like.
And so we'll be back next week.
We'll be back next week with another episode of State House Watch. We want to thank you all for listening. We are going down the road.
Going where the water tastes like wine. Over. Going down the road, beating bare.